Welcome to Cropcast, a series of monthly arable podcasts bringing you the latest information, timely updates and expert advice. In today's episode,
we are looking to bring that consistency to this product. We trialed it over a good number of years now, and we are seeing that when applied in the right conditions, which is what we've been doing and proven, is a product that can consistently do what it's meant to be doing, which is to help crops with its nitrogen use efficiency.
I am Tiffany Stevenson. This is the second part of a two-part series on natural products. In the first episode, we talked about what natural products are and focus in on elicitors with Dr. Neil Havis. This is the second episode of this two-part podcast, and today we're talking about biostimulants and a new product which is on the market called Vixarin, where we are joined by Andy Cunningham from Syngenta. If you haven't already listened to the first episode, please do go back and have a listen. Welcome, Andy. Would you like to begin by introducing yourself?
Hello, Tiffany. Yeah, so I'm Andy Cunningham. I'm one of the technical managers in the Syngenta UK business. Part of my role is to look after foliar biostimulants, and we are launching a new product this coming spring called Vixarin.
It sounds very exciting. Before we ask you about Vixarin, would you like to just give your viewpoint on biostimulants at the moment? Because I know people are quite wary of them because there doesn't seem to be very clear regulations around them.
Absolutely. It does feel like a loaded question, that one, Tiffany. It is a challenge, biostimulants. They've been around for so long, haven't they? Some with a lot of credible data behind them and some maybe not so. It is definitely an area that, from a Syngenta point of view, we are aware of the fact that there is a lot of biostimulants on the market with these really good claims, and a lot of them will be able to prove them probably under some really nice controlled scenarios. The problem is when you take these products into the real world or into the field and they start to become a little bit less consistent, potentially maybe not even showing their benefit at all. And it's one of the reasons why that when we are coming into this sort of area of products, that we are going into it with knowing that we do need to invest quite significantly into it, so that we know that when we do bring a product to market, we've tested it enough times in different scenarios, in different crops, that when we do bring it, we know exactly what it's going to do, and to ensure that it is as consistent as a biostimulant can ever be, really.
That's good to hear that you are trying it in a lot of different scenarios. Am I right in thinking you'll be trying different soil types, different climates, different areas of the country with it?
Absolutely, yeah. But not only just in the UK, but also across the pond into our European friends. So we've done trials in Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, and in the Nordics. And hopefully that gives your growers the confidence that this product is one that actually says what it, or does what it says on the tin.
So there has been a lot of work going on, and you've got a new product that's come to market. Is it new for this year, am I right in thinking?
It's new for the UK. They launched it in, I believe, the Nordics last year, but it's new for the UK. And something I really wanted to sort of stress, really, around the biostimulant sector, because this is a biostimulant, it is classed as that. Part of my background before I joined Syngenta in 2016 was working with crop protection products in independent field trials, and inevitably with synthetic products. Some will come with varying degrees of effectiveness, but the one thing that they do have is that consistent approach with how they work, and that's definitely something that biostimulants could learn from. And we are looking to bring that consistency to this product. We trialed it over a good number of years now, and we are seeing that when applied in the right conditions, which is what we've been doing and proven, is a product that can consistently do what it's meant to be doing, which is to help crops with its nitrogen use efficiency.
So your new product is Vixarin. Would you like to explain how it's designed to work?
So Vixarin is a free living bacteria from the Azobacter selenestris bacterial strains. In fact, it's a certain strain of that. It's called the CECT9690. I know it just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? But this particular strain of Azobacter is very strong in its nitrogen fixation properties, because there is a lot of Azobacter strains out there, but this one in particular is very strong in its nitrogen fixing ability. It is a free living bacteria, and that's important to reference, because although it fixes nitrogen and will colonize a plant, so it is an endophyte, which is a bacteria that will colonize a plant, it can also survive outside the plant as well. And that means that it makes it more resilient because it survives in the soil, but it also enables it to have more than one entry point into the plant. So it means that when it gets into the soil system, the rhizosphere, it can not only help with the fertility of the soil, but it can also colonize the root system as well. So it means we get a nice whole rounded colonization of the plant rather than just solely relying on that foliar uptake of this bacteria. And once it's in there, I don't know if you realize, but the atmosphere around us actually contains 78% nitrogen, but it's in a form that we can't utilize. It's in this dinitrogen. And what the bacteria does, it uses an enzyme called nitrogenase, and it's able to fix this nitrogen, break out the two nitrogen molecules, fix some hydrogen to it, and create ammonium, which is then available for the plant to utilize. And we've done some, again, going back to these control scenarios, but some really nice control scenarios, which not only prove that this bacteria can fix nitrogen, but it can also supply it to a growing crop as well.
Okay, so yeah, that sounded really complicated, but am I right? Just checking that I've picked this up correctly. You've got bacteria which can live in the soil and on the plants, and the bacteria is able to fix nitrogen and make it into a form which the crop can use.
You've got my job. You may as well. Yeah, you've nailed it. That's exactly what it does. Yeah.
Perfect. So the nitrogen that it's using, that's just in the atmosphere anyway. It's not necessarily come from fertilizers originally. It could have just been there anyway.
Absolutely. Yes, it doesn't break down the nitrogen that is in that artificial fertilizer. It is utilizing the nitrogen from the atmosphere. In fact, the process that we utilize to get artificial fertilizer, the Haber-Bosch process, is basically doing the same thing. It's taking the atmospheric nitrogen and fixing it into an available form for the plant to utilize. It's just not using all the energy that is required to do that through that Haber-Bosch process.
So using Vixarun, will that help fill the gap between supply and demand of nitrogen for the crop potentially?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. We do have two different standpoints, particularly into cereals. When we think about artificial fertilizer, there are costs applied to that. Now, that could be financial, and we don't want to be applying too much to the crop, because there's only so much that it can actually utilize. But there is also a cost to the environment as well. You know, if we apply too much, it could actually leach through the soil profile. I'm sure you might have done your GCSE biology, but you know that nitrogen getting into watercourses can cause eutrophication, and there are costs regards to that, but also it's the cost implications for the manufacturing process and everything involved in that can actually increase the amount of CO2 that's delivered to the environment. So if we are only using the amount of nitrogen or artificial nitrogen that is solely required by that crop, then we can bring in Vixarun to either be in a position to reduce our nitrogen and compensate for that and achieve the same yields as if we hadn't reduced nitrogen, or we can have a nice complementary benefit where we can improve yields on top of your optimum nitrogen regime. And we've done a lot of trials to prove both of them scenarios. Where we think about that compensatory benefit, we are confident we can replace 30 kilograms off an optimized nitrogen regime, but we've actually had trials that would actually say we could compensate more than that as well. So it is a nice little function of this bacteria.
It feels like it's coming at a good time when everyone's thinking about the environment and climate change, that actually this coming along now is the time where everyone's got it in the back of their minds trying to be more environmentally friendly. And by the sounds of it, if it's saving a bit of the manufacture of synthetic fertilizers, it does have a benefit there as well.
So it's not by design, Tiffany, that we've brought this product to market now. I guess it's just a nice little coincidence. I would actually say, yeah, outside of them environmental benefits that Vicks can bring, I think we're all aware just how backward our crops are at the moment, and the fact that our crops probably haven't established as well as we'd like them to. Maybe the root system haven't got into the soil profile as far as they would normally do as well. So a crop that's actually going to be scavenging for nutrients in the soil is probably going to be limited. So having a product like Vixrin that can supplement the crop's nitrogen requirement is going to be key. And coupled together that with the amount of rainfall we've had, I think we're fully aware that the soil nitrogen supply is going to be as low as it's ever been. So this seems like an even more important product to be bringing to market than ever.
So what crops are you able to use the product on?
So we've done a lot of work on cereals, particularly winter cereals. And if we think about the two scenarios that I've spoken about, that complementary and compensatory benefit, it will depend on which of them scenarios that you're using Vixrin for which crops you'll use it on. So if we think about that reduction benefit in your nitrogen regime, we would say if you're doing that, stick to your feed wheats and your feed barleys. If you're looking at that complementary benefit, then that is where we would say this is a nice fit for your quality wheats on top of your feed wheats and your feed barleys as well. But outside of cereals, any crop that requires nitrogen, pretty much Vixrin has shown some really nice benefits. And we've been doing some work in particularly maize, grassland, sugar beet. And one particular crop that I'm quite intrigued about and excited about is pulses, so beans. Now, as I'm sure you are aware, beans have the ability to fix their own nitrogen because of the rhizobium that's in the nodules in the root system. But when you start looking into the relationship that beans or peas have with them rhizobium, you start to understand why Vixrin can bring a nice benefit in this. So the nodules will actually start developing on that root system probably 3-5 weeks after emergence. And then the rhizobium will fix nitrogen very similar to the bacteria that we have in Vixrin through that season. But exactly when you want that nitrogen in that crop, because as we know, beans are a great source of protein, and protein need nitrogen as a key requirement for building that. Exactly when the seeds is going to start developing in the pods, these nodules will actually start senescing off. So inevitably, that source of nitrogen that these seeds to fill will be required to be robbed from the leaves. And inevitably, the green leaf area potential of the crop is reduced. By having Vixrin in the crop to supplement the nitrogen that is delivered from the leaves, it means the crop stays greener for that slight bit longer. And we've had some really nice benefits in the indication trials that we've done in 2023. In fact, I think we had, of the four trials that we did, granted it's only four, but we had four positive results with an average of over half a ton per hectare just by an application of Vixrin. So it's that one is one that seems to be of particular interest, not only to us at Syngenta, but some people who might be growing them sort of crops.
Have you done any trials in Scotland?
We have. And particularly one trial that I do like to reference is from Scotland, where we look at the benefits of this product in Scottish conditions. Because as we know, with living organisms, we, like humans, behave more favourably in better conditions. And that is not too dissimilar to what bacteria like. So I've kind of alluded to the fact that we've done a lot of trials with this product. And we trialed and tested it, and sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes it does. So then I think we need to learn from the scenarios where it doesn't work more than we do from where it does. And what we understand is the conditions at the time of application need to be favourable for the plant, but also the bacteria, to ensure that we get good multiplication of this bacteria, but also good colonisation. Where we've had trials perform in slight contradictory to that, kind of highlight the benefits of the resilience of this bacteria. So, for example, we did a trial on some King's Barn winter barley in a full nitrogen regime and slightly reduced. On the day of application, temperatures were quite positive for the bacteria and the plant. But 5 days before and after, we were having temperatures below 0 degrees, which I wouldn't have said were good for the bacteria nor for the plant. But because we have that soil acting ability of this bacteria, plus the fact, which is something I've not mentioned yet, Tiffany, is that this bacteria has the ability to create a cyst when it's in conditions it doesn't like, it means that it can actually survive in conditions that other bacteria won't. And it means that when conditions become more favourable, we do get reactivization of the bacteria and we get that colonisation. So in these conditions that we had in Scotland, which might not have been true to exactly how we want this bacteria to be applied, we were still seeing a really nice benefit. And that was in some Scottish data that I do reference in a lot of the work that I do present.
It's great to hear that it can withstand unfavourable conditions as well, because I know quite often you feel like it's going to be a good week and then suddenly you're going to get hit by some more rain or some cold weather and you just don't know what's coming in Scotland at this time of year. So it is really pleasing to hear. What sort of growth stages would you be looking at applying it?
So in cereals, we suggest that it goes on at the sort of mid-tillering, early semi-extension stage. That is because we know that cereal crops will utilise probably 70% of its nitrogen requirement between the growth stages of 21 and 39. So getting this product in at then times is key to ensuring that we're getting the best out of this product. Now, if we think about other crops, and going back to the pulses aspect, where we've seen applications at the start of the first sign of fluorescence on the crop appears to be the best timing for them crops as well. In all different crops, we'll all have different growth stage timings that we start recommending, but we will have good guidance on that on the label for the crops that we've got good trials data to back up any claims that we do have.
So when you're applying the product, I'm guessing it's just going through a sprayer?
Yes, it is a fully applied product. I did allude to the fact that it is able to create a cyst, which is how it protects itself when it's in unfavourable conditions. It does mean that it makes it more resilient in the atmosphere and the environment. That is correct. But what it also does is that it means that we have a good mixability with crop protection products. Now, on our website, we do have such a list of the products that we've tested that it is biologically compatible with, and that is available on our website, as I say, because it is something where I see that this is a product where you have to be able to apply it with your standard CP timings. So I would see in cereals, the T0 fungicide timing is the key time to get it in. The crop is going to be actively growing. The temperatures are going to be favorable for this bacteria, and you're going in anyway. Going in with a separate pass does always make things tricky, particularly where we are at this moment in time where we're all struggling to get onto the land in the first place.
We'll put a link to Syngenta in the show notes so people can then find it and easily go and have a look on their website on to find out what products is compatible with and what the best timings are. For cereals, is it just one application you're making or could you apply it more than once?
So in cereals, we see one application is sufficient. What we are looking at this year, though, is whether later applications, so at the T2, T3 timing, might actually impact in a positive fashion on the grain quality. So we might not maybe be influencing grain yield or yield of the crop at that point, but I'd like to think we might be able to influence the grain protein of, of the crop. So, but in short, relatively short cropping cycles, I see one application being okay. Where we start to look into longer crops, so sugar beet, for example, that are growing through the main bulk of the growing season, there may be a couple of applications would be sufficient. What we know with this product is that we do have 4 months, at least 4 months of activity, which is peaked at 2 months after it's been applied. So if you can imagine your cereal crop in April, May, by the time you get to 2-3 months down the line, the crop is at that point of crop senescence. So there's no need to put another one on. If you think about sugar beet, for example, and you go on relatively early, or if you've got fodder beet, for example, you go in at the 4-6 leaf true leaf stage. 3 months down the line, your crop is, or the roots are still bulking under the ground. So enabling that crop with another input of nitrogen being supplied by our bacteria is going to be a benefit.
So for Vixarin, what sort of application rate are we looking at?
So it does actually have quite a low application rate. It's supplied at 50 grams per hectare, which does seem quite low, doesn't it? But even at that low rate, we do have a really nice colonizing forming unit, which is a measurement of how fast the bacteria will grow. And we do have a nice colonizing forming unit of 10 million, which can actually multiply up 100 times in 6 days under the right conditions. So temperatures around 12, 10 degrees is the perfect conditions for this bacteria to multiply.
Back at the beginning of the podcast, we mentioned about nitrogen getting into watercourses. Is there a risk of this getting into watercourses?
So this bacteria does not contain nitrogen. There is no issues with that at all. And I suppose you've led me down to an area that I particularly wanted to really reference. Where we've had this product registered, and I'm referencing my French colleagues at this point, because the Europeans do have to have this product registered as a biostimulant as opposed to what we do in the UK. Because it is a microorganism, as a general sort of precautionary statement, on a registration package, they will have do not apply to edible parts because it's a microorganism. What we've been able to prove with our bacteria is that it's very safe as well. So it can be applied. So we've had that statement removed off our registration package, which is really positive from not only a safety to the environment, but also a safetiness to either humans, if you're applying it to products that we're going to eat in the end, but also livestock. Think about the grassland part of it. This is something that will be fine and safe and absolutely get it put onto your grassland, absolutely.
So if there's no restrictions on the product, that will make it much more appealing if people aren't worrying about what they're putting it onto and when.
Absolutely, yeah. There is no restrictions about this product at all. The fact that it is a biostimulant is one of the benefits that comes with that tag. You know, you could apply it to any crop, even if it's not really on the label.
Okay, just thinking from a cost point of view, I'm not worried about the exact cost, and I know fertilizer prices are fluctuating a lot, so it's hard to always compare. But do you think it was probably about cost the same to go and cut 30-40 kilograms of nitrogen and apply the product, or do you think it might be a bit more expensive or a bit cheaper?
Good question, Tiffany. So the cost of this product is going to be cheaper than a kilogram of nitrogen, for example. So saving 30 kilograms, you can basically do the maths. It is going to be less than £30 a hectare of an application, absolutely. Now, how much it's going to be to where you get it from, I can't guarantee. But I would like to think it's going to be low 20s from where it should be. So
there is the potential there to go and cut your fertilizer bill slightly and use the product.
Absolutely. But given what we said at the start of this podcast, where our crops are at this moment in time, I do see that complementary benefit being the key for where this product could be applied this year to get the crops that are struggling a little bit backward, to get them kicked on and as healthy as we can do, so that we can get the yields that we want at the end of the season.
So as the product has no nitrogen in, is it able to be used on an organic farm?
We do have it registered with the Organic Farmers and Growers, so that is a positive. I'm aiming to achieve verification with the Soil Association, and that is ongoing at this moment in time. So I can hopefully, you could maybe put that in the notes if we get it between now and when you release this, but all being well in the next couple of weeks, it should be on the verified list with the Soil Association as well.
So it's definitely something for people to look out for going forward, because I know people are always looking for different things for organic farmers as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I see this is a really good input for that market, particularly because from an artificial nitrogen point of view, they are restricted, aren't they? So having this as a tool in their armory just feel like a really nice product to apply.
So have you had a look at what the carbon footprint of the product is?
It's funny you say that, Tiffany, actually. We do actually know the cradle to grave of Vixarin. And what I mean by that is the manufacturing to the application of Vixarin is just over 3 kilograms of CO2 per hectare of an application, which is hardly anything. And if you can reduce your nitrogen inputs by 30 kilograms of nitrogen, having Vixarin to supplement that can actually reduce your CO2 emissions by nearly 13%.
Just to finish off, Andy, what would your top tips for farmers who are interested in using Vixarin be?
Yeah, so I suppose find out as much as you can from this product. We've got a really good website with all the information that you'd need at hand, so you can have a look about it. Hopefully there's a recording of a webinar that I did a few weeks ago, which hopefully summarizes exactly what we spoke about quite nicely. From an application point of view, I spoke about the conditions that this product loves to be in. So ensuring on the day of application that temperatures aren't getting below 4 degrees and temperatures are reaching 10 to 12 degrees on the day. I think that's one of the key ways that we get the most out of this product. And finally, I think we'll have open days around the country up in Scotland. So visit our website again to find out where we are, and we'll either have Vixarin on site or we'll have staff on hand to tell you all about it if you want to find out more at that point.
It sounds like a really good product. It'd be really interesting to hear feedback after it's been on the market in the UK this year and see how farmers find the product. But I'd be very hopeful that with all the testing you've done in so many different conditions and different countries and doing all those trials, I'm very hopeful it lives up to the expectations now.
I hope so too, Tiffany. We've done a lot of work. And it does seem to be a product that we're excited about. Absolutely, it's Syngenta. So I appreciate the time that you've allowed me to talk about this product. And yeah, good luck to all the growers out there.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Now we have an update from out in the field.
Hi, my name is Mark Basher-Gibbs and I'm a consultant with SAC Consulting. As we are all very well aware, we're coming into a very much later period than usual for getting spring crops into the ground. And for the majority of growers, it'll be into April before ground conditions allow for any kind of field work and seedbed preparation. Spring beans would ideally have been sown in March, and there may be a few that have managed to get beans in the ground. And for crops like spring barley, spring wheat and oats, most crops will be sown through April, with the last to go in possibly as late as early May. In a late season like this, final yields will be influenced to a greater degree by the extent to which plants can tiller before moving into their reproductive growth stages. Soil moisture and good seed-to-soil contact is required for good germination. However, where soil is very wet, such as a season like this, oxygen becomes a limiting factor which can reduce germination. One way we can help mitigate the downsides of late sowing this year is to pay particular attention to seed rates, so we optimise the number of ears per metre squared come harvest. Of course, we know spring barley has a better capacity for tillering, while spring oats and spring wheats less so. When calculating seed rates through April, aim to establish 350 plants per metre squared for spring barley, 360 plants per metre squared for spring oats, and 380 plants per metre squared for spring wheat. Your final seed rate calculation should account for the seed's 1,000 grain weight, the germination percentage, and your expectations for establishment rate. As a general rule of thumb, increase seed rates by 50 seeds per metre squared from your original calculation for each week that sowing is delayed beyond the first week of April. This will help achieve target fertile tiller numbers through to harvest.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Cropcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe or follow. If you want to find out more about anything we've discussed on the show, or you'd like to get in touch, you can find our details in the show notes. If you enjoy listening to Cropcast, you may enjoy some of our other podcasts, such as Natural Capital, where the most recent episode discusses agri-environment schemes, also known as EECs, which supports farmers wanting to implement sustainable land management practices. Find out about the opportunities to create, restore, and enhance natural capital assets and how you can apply in the podcast. If you haven't already listened to the first episode, please do go back and have a listen. Please do let us know what you think about having a two-part series. We look forward to seeing you again in May for the next episode of Cropcast due out on the 22nd of May. We look forward to seeing you then. This episode was hosted by myself, Tiffany Stevenson, produced by George Gawley, executive produced by Kerry Hammond, and edited by Cameron Roch. This podcast is produced in association with the Scottish Government.
The Farm Advisory Service Podcast. Audio advice on livestock, crops and soils, environment, rural business, and more. Brought to you in association with the Scottish Government.